Test for English Majors, 2012, Grade 8, Part 1, Listening Comprehension, Section A, Mini Lecture. In this section, you will hear a mini lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a gap-filling task after the mini-lecture. When the lecture is over, you will be given 2 minutes to check your notes, and another 10 minutes to complete the gap-filling task on answer sheet 1, using no more than 3 words in each gap. Make sure the word or words you fill in is or are both grammatically and semantically acceptable. You may refer to your notes while completing the task. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Now, listen to the mini-lecture.
Observing behavior. Good morning, everyone. Today, we'll look at how to observe behavior in research. Perhaps you would say it's easy and there's nothing extraordinary. Yes, you may be right. All of us observe behavior every day. For example, when traveling in another country, we can avoid embarrassment by observing how people behave in that culture. And failing to be observant while walking or driving can be life-threatening. We learn by observing people's behavior. Researchers, too, rely on their observations to learn about behavior. But there are differences. For instance, when we observe casually, we may not be aware of factors that bias our observations. And when we rarely keep formal records of our observations. Instead, we rely on our memory of events. Observations in research, on the other hand, are made under precisely defined conditions, that is, in a systematic and objective manner, and with careful record-keeping. Then, how are we going to conduct observations in our research studies, and what do we need to do in order to make a scientific and objective observation? Now, as you remember, the primary goal of observation is to describe behavior. But it is, in reality, impossible to observe and describe all of a person's behavior. So we have to rely on observing samples of people's behavior. In doing so, we must decide whether the samples represent people's usual behavior. Thus, we'll first take a brief look at how researchers select samples of behavior. Before conducting an observational study, researchers must make a number of important decisions. That's about when and where observations will be made. As I've said before, the researcher cannot observe all behavior. Only certain behaviors occurring at particular times, in specific settings, can be observed. In other words, behavior must be sampled. In this lecture, I'll briefly introduce two kinds of sampling, that is, time sampling and situation sampling. Now, first, time sampling. Time sampling means that researchers choose various time intervals for their observation. Intervals may be selected systematically or randomly. Suppose we want to observe students' classroom behavior. Then, in systematic time sampling, our observations might be made during 5 20-minute periods beginning every hour. The first observation period could begin at 9 a.m., the second at 10 a.m., and so forth. However, in random sampling, these 5 20-minute periods may be distributed randomly over the course of the day. That is to say, intervals between observation periods could vary, some longer, others shorter. One point I'd like to make is, systematic and random time sampling are not always used in isolation. They are often combined in studies. For example, while observation intervals are scheduled systematically, observations within an interval are made at random times. That means the researcher might decide to observe only during 15-second intervals that are randomly distributed within each 20-minute period. Now let's come to situation sampling. Then, what is situation sampling? It involves studying behavior in different locations and under different circumstances and conditions. By sampling as many different situations as possible, researchers can reduce the chance that their observation results will be peculiar to a certain set of circumstances and conditions. Why? Because people, or for that matter animals, do not behave in exactly the same way across all situations. For example, children do not always behave the same way with one parent as they do with the other parent. And animals do not behave the same way in zoos as they do in the wild. So, by sampling different situations, a researcher can make more objective observations than he would in only a specific situation. Having discussed ways to sample behavior in research, we are now moving on to another issue, that is, what researchers should do to record behavior as it occurs. That is, whether researchers are active or passive in recording behavior. This refers to the methods of observation. Observational methods can be classified as observation with intervention or observation without intervention. Observation with intervention can be made in at least two ways, participant observation and field experiment. In participant observation, observers, that is, researchers, play a dual role. They observe people's behavior, and they participate actively in the situation they are observing. If individuals who are being observed know that the observer is present to collect information about their behavior, this is undisguised participant observation. But in disguised participant observation, those who are being observed do not know that they are being observed. Another method of observation with intervention is field experiment. What is a field experiment? When an observer controls one or more conditions in a natural setting in order to determine their effect on behavior, this procedure is called field experiment. The field experiment represents the most extreme form of intervention in observational methods. The essential difference between field experiments and other observational methods is that researchers have more control in field experiments. Now let's take a look at observation without intervention. Observation without intervention is also called naturalistic observation because its main purpose is to describe behavior as it normally occurs, that is, in a natural setting, without any attempt by the observer to intervene. An observer using this method of observation acts as a passive recorder of what occurs. The events occur naturally and are not controlled by the observer. Okay, in today's lecture we have focused on how to make decisions of sampling before beginning our observation, and what we can do during observation. I hope what we've discussed will help you in your future research design.
Now you have 2 minutes to check your notes, and then please complete the gap-filling task on answer sheet 1 in 10 minutes. Section B. Interview. In this section, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Mark the best answer to each question on answer sheet 2. Questions 1 to 5 are based on an interview. At the end of the interview, you will be given 10 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now listen to the interview. People often wonder how the human brain creates, for example, a beautiful painting, a sculpture, or even a delicious dinner. Today, we are honored to have Dr. Nancy Andreasen, a neuroscientist at the University of Iowa, on our talk show. Dr. Andreasen has recently written a book called The Creating Brain, The Neuroscience of Genius. In her book, she tackles the question and tries to look into the brain behind creativity. Dr. Andreasen, thanks for coming on our show.
Pleasure.
Now, Dr. Andreasen, can we start with a question? What is creativity?
Well, creativity can be seen as a process. This process starts with a person, for example, an artist, musician, inventor, or even someone who's trying to figure out a better way of doing a task at work or at home. That person must think about the problem or their project in a novel way and then come up with a solution.
I see. But how long will it take for the person to find the solution, as it were?
Well, it depends. The creative process can go by in a flash, or it can take years. But the end result is, invariably, the production of something new and useful, such as the automobile, or something beautiful and artistic, such as a painting by Vincent van Gogh.
Dr. Andreasen, then, do you think the ability to be creative is inborn or not?
Well, no one knows yet if the ability to be creative, for example, the ability to produce a haunting symphony, is the result of the environment or a genetic makeup that allows people to be creative more easily. However, creativity does seem to run in certain families.
Is that so?
Yes. You see, Johann Sebastian Bach was the most famous member of the Bach family, but there were 20 other eminent musicians who came from the same family.
That's very interesting. Now, Dr. Andreasen, we've so far been talking about those famous creative people like Van Gogh or Bach, who have produced great pieces of work. Does that mean that creativity only resides in great people?
No, certainly not. Creativity is not limited, to the masterpiece work of art, but can also be found in everyday tasks such as cooking or gardening.
Oh, really?
For example, a cook changes a recipe or even makes one up using ingredients he or she has on hand to produce a new one. He is, in fact, using the creative process to create novel taste sensations.
So, can we say both famous and ordinary people can be creative?
Yes.
Now, Dr. Andreasen, could you describe to us what the actual creative process is?
Okay. Artists, musicians, and writers often describe periods during which they're relying on ordinary creativity. For example, writers can spend hours at the keyboard putting thoughts together. This process is similar to the way people put together novel ideas when talking. And many great artists also describe a dreamlike state during which a symphony, a poem, or the idea for the ending of a play comes to them in a flash.
So what's going on in the brain during the flash of inspiration?
Well, for the moment, no one knows for sure, but research suggests that creative people often slip into a zone in which ideas and thoughts come up freely in a sort of disorganized way. During that state, a part of the brain becomes very active. And that brain region is known to be able to link up ideas or thoughts in potentially novel ways.
I see. Another question. Do you think there is a creative personality?
Well, perhaps we can put it this way. Gifted people in the arts or science tend to enjoy adventure. They often like to explore new places or ideas. They don't like being hemmed in by rules or convention, and they often look at problems from a different angle. Another point is they often have to move doggedly ahead on a project, even when the outside world rejects their art or new ideas.
Dr. Andreasen, what about the role of the environment in the creative process?
Environment does play a role. You see, there have been hotbeds of creativity throughout history. For example, the city of Florence during the Renaissance period was home to both Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. Both men, in fact, came from families that didn't especially value creativity. Yet someone noticed a spark of talent in them, and both got the training and financial backing to produce extraordinary pieces of art.
Since the environment helps in the creative process, are there ways for people to build a better, more creative brain?
Well, I'd suggest that you spend 30 minutes a day on a creativity workout.
Oh, could you say a bit more about that?
Yes, you do three things. First, explore an unfamiliar area of knowledge. For example, people who use a lot of math on the job should sign up for a painting class.
The second?
The second is spend time each day thinking. This means that you don't censor your thoughts, but allow your mind to go freely to a problem and see what kind of solutions or ideas come up.
Next thing?
That is, practice the art of paying attention. Look for and really observe a person, an object, or something in your daily commute that you hadn't noticed before. Try describing or drawing that object in a journal or sketchbook.
I hope your advice will help people to train their brain to be creative. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Andreasen, for talking on the show.
Not at all.
Section C, News Broadcast. In this section, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Mark the best answer to each question on answer sheet 2. Question 6 is based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 10 seconds to answer the question. Now listen to the news.
NASA astronauts successfully installed a new ammonia pump on the International Space Station Monday during their third spacewalk to make the emergency repairs. The astronauts do not yet know whether their efforts were enough to restore the space station's cooling system to full capacity. It took three spacewalks totaling more than 22 hours, but astronauts Doug Wheelock and Tracy Caldwell Dyson managed to move the 350-kilogram replacement pump into position. They tightened bolts and made connections so ammonia could flow into the module. NASA called the success a big step in the right direction. The space station's cooling system has been running at half capacity for more than 2 weeks. On July 31st, an ammonia pump failed. Another module continued to pump coolant through a separate loop, but astronauts had to power down non-essential equipment to prevent overheating. The space station's deputy program manager, Kirk Shearman, said the team did an outstanding job coping with what he called a major malfunction.
Questions 7 and 8 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 20 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news.
Pediatricians from a U.S. university have taken a look at one measure of children's well-being in Egypt, the Philippines, and India, the extent to which children are subject to corporal punishment and abuse. The data reveal interesting cultural differences about what seems to be acceptable when it comes to physically disciplining children. Among the things we learned, for instance, was that in India, slapping a child in the face or head is more common than spanking them, the researchers say. And in Egypt, 25% of the mothers said that they had beaten their child up, which was defined as hitting them over and over again with a closed fist. And then the other interesting things were, like the Philippines, the rate of telling people that evil spirits were going to get them, the kind of emotional, kind of threatening to lock them out of the home, was very high. However, despite the differences in punishment methods, some notable similarities have been found. For example, the education level of mothers impacted how often they resorted to physical discipline. The more years of education, the lower the rate of harsh physical punishment in kids.
Questions 9 and 10 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 20 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news.
Officials say Japan lost its place as the world's number two economy to China in the second quarter, as the island nation's economic growth slowed to a crawl. Japan's cabinet office said Monday that gross domestic product rose an annualized 0.4% in the 3 months ended June 3rd, compared with a revised 4.4% expansion in the first quarter. Monday's report said export growth slowed and consumer spending stalled. The expansion was weaker than economists estimated, with their predictions ranging from 0.6% to 3.4%. Analysts say China's economy will almost certainly be bigger than Japan's at the end of the year because of the big difference in each country's growth rates. China is growing at about 10% per year, while Japan's economy is forecast to grow 3% this year.
This is the end of listening comprehension. Please proceed to the next part.